This is Kristen Farrick for The Art World Demystified, and I'm here with Umbreen Inayat, the artistic producer for Nuit Blanche in Toronto. Umbreen, thank you for being here today.
It's my pleasure. I'm excited to talk to you.
So, to begin with, what is Nuit Blanche for people who have never heard of it?
So, Nuit Blanche is an all-night contemporary art event. Mm-hmm. And what that means is from dusk till dawn, we transform the city with art projects that basically take over spaces, invite the public in, and really sort of change your thoughts on how you view the city and how you view art and how you view the people around you.
So was it, where was it invented?
In Paris. So it started off in Paris, I think about, 10, 15 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And the way it came to us is that the mayor of Paris at that time in 2006 had approached our mayor Miller mm-hmm. and said, hey, do you want to partner with us on this event that he created?
Mm-hmm.
And then Mayor Miller said, sure, let's try this out. And so the city produced it in 2006 for the first time with about an attendance of 500,000.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah.
Right off the top.
Right off the top. And that's when the mayor said, there's something here in this event and we really need to invest in it and see it grow.
So it is actually produced by the City of Toronto, and so you are an employee of the city.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. So my title is Programming Supervisor for the City of Toronto in Arts and Culture, Economic Development, and it's super long. So what we call ourselves is Artistic Producers.
Mm-hmm. And so I guess the city sees the economic benefit to putting on a large event like that.
Yeah, and to be honest, it's kind of what's kept us alive
mm-hmm.
because we generate about $48 million in spending in just one night alone.
Wow.
And so, that's even though in the arts we don't really like to talk about economics because it takes away from what the art is, it, in our case, mm-hmm. has kept the event alive.
Yes. What is your role? What do you do as artistic producer for this big event?
So I'm going into my ninth year of Nuit Blanche. I've been doing it probably closer to, probably the longest person that I know in the department. And now I'm the programming lead. So what that means is I'm like the lead strategist. And I think about who are the curators we want to invite to submit proposals. I broker those relationships. Mm. I talk to them and sort of coach them on how to sort of create a story, a curatorial vision mm-hmm. that has a narrative that could transform the city.
Mm-hmm.
And then I actually get proposals from them, work with them on it. We jury them. And then I actually produce an exhibition area as well while I'm strategizing on the next year and the next year and the next year.
So you produce your own exhibition at the same time as
yeah.
there are other curators.
So exactly.
So is there each year there's a different theme, or how does that work?
So what we do is we invite curators to submit curatorial themes.
Right.
And so from that, sometimes we can pull an overarching theme, mm-hmm. like for the first time we're doing it in 2017 for the 150th Confederation anniversary for Canada.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about, Canada possible futures, but we don't normally do that. We kind of let each curator tell their own story.
Uh-huh.
Because we kind of want a different flavor, a different vibe to each part of the city that you go to. So
right.
it's not just one thing repetitive over and over again.
Right. Each section of the city has a different curator?
Exactly, exactly.
And how many curators would that
entail? So we normally have City Hall,
mm-hmm.
which is, a monumental project, and then there's three other exhibitions on top of City Hall.
Right.
Yeah.
And how much area does that cover in the city?
It's weird because we're kind of like crowd psychologists, so we plan out, how big is a good size exhibition? How close can it be to each other so you don't want to like kill yourself going from one to the other?
Mm-hmm.
How do you include discovery of new neighborhoods? So we sort of patchwork. You create these sort of building blocks and mm-hmm. then you move them slowly all around the city. So it could be, if we're going to have something at City Hall, we try and think of a link down Bay Street or down Queen or down University as another exhibition
mm-hmm.
that would link to maybe, Fort York, so that would be another exhibition.
Right.
And then, this year we're trying to go towards the waterfront, so that how can we bring audiences down to the waterfront so mm-hmm. we create another exhibition area. It's kind of like being a, urban planner / strategist / crowd psychologist / artistic producer.
Mm-hmm. So, wow. And what is your background? Are you from the arts, or how did you get into doing this?
It's funny. My story is pretty crazy. I'm actually a social worker, and I have a background in psychology and psychotherapy. So it's interesting. I know it's funny. Basically, I started off always caring about things, caring about causes, caring about people, and so I would always get involved in events when I was little, whether it be car wash, whether that would be a fundraiser. I fundraised my life away for any cause, and I think it's because I wanted to be involved. I want to be part of something creative, and I want it to be for a larger purpose.
Right.
And then it finally hit me when I decided to go to university, almost at the end of school, that, hey, I think I want to take this further. Because before, I was just sort of like this community activist and self-starter in a way.
Yes.
And I went to school, and I did anthropology and women's studies.
Mm-hmm.
And I loved the role that art played, in society, history, culture, and how art is a tool to communicate with each other. We studied hieroglyphics to ancient antiquity, to Egypt, to Papua New Guinea. And I love the role that art played. People left their mark through it. People were holding a mirror up for people to reflect upon, and I really do believe that artists' role is to move society forward, because they sort of get you to think about things that we normally wouldn't, we ignore. And I started to, think about the powerful role that it plays in our lives. And then I always think about a larger purpose. So randomly enough, I wrote this play about, women's issues and abuse, because I was involved in theater and the vagina monologues. Through that play, I sort of decided that I wanted to have a large platform to tell a story.
Yes.
Because I threw this play at the St. Lawrence Center for the Arts. Almost 500 people came. I raised $14,000 for a women's shelter. And I thought, okay, I've been doing this my whole life. This is the most successful. And I realized it's because we had stars in the show. We had the biggest theater involved.
Yes.
We tied it to a shelter. And I'm like, this is cool. I like this. The larger, the better the medium, the stronger your message is. And then I randomly applied for my master's in social work. I'm super scatterbrained, and I thought, well, do I want to do anthropology? Do I want to do women's studies? Do I want to do social work? And I thought, there's no way in hell I'm doing women's studies anymore. I'm sick and tired of feminists talking to other feminists. That's not how change happens. You have to bring it into the world. So I'm like, forget it. And then I thought, am I going to do anthropology? And I actually applied to do my master's in anthropology, and I got in. But my gut was telling me to not go. And, when something is really hurting in my stomach, it means don't do it. And I listened to that voice. And so I just, I deferred my acceptance for about 3 years.
Right.
I started doing everything. I was like a job whore in a way. I was working at Harbourfront. I was working at Tourism Toronto. I think I had a job at the Ministry of Health, I was out there just trying to learn my city and learn about me, because I just didn't feel like I fit in anywhere. I randomly applied for social work in my master's because I thought, why not? Why the hell not? And I didn't even care. And I find that in my life, I've been getting the jobs when I have been least desperate for them. And so when I applied for my master's, I was like, I am a person of color and I want to make change. And, I think that art is a powerful tool, and my parents are two different religions and I come from this background, and I think that I have something to say. And I just wasn't thinking anything of it. And then the day of my show, for the Vagina Monologues, I get this acceptance from U of T. And I remember getting this big package, and I said, holy shit, what am I going to do now? So then I thought to myself, I have to do this. It's a little bit more practical, because for my entire life, I was just doing what I felt like and what felt good, even though, my mom was like, why are you doing women's studies? You could study me and give me all the money, and anthropology, I was the only brown girl in there, and I always sort of felt like I didn't fit in, but I was curious about everything. And so when the acceptance came from U of T, I thought, I better do this, because it's the smart thing to do. It's kind of like a ticket, And I remember doing a career quiz. It was like monster.ca, and I was filling out this form, and I was like, what am I meant to do? And I filled out this form. It was like a multiple choice question, and the answer came up saying, you are, most suited to an alternate career. And I was like, what the hell is that? And I realized now it meant that I, was supposed to chart my own path. And that's what I did. So I went and did my master's at U of T in social work. And I was like, okay, we're going to talk about resistance and, addictions and abuse and First Nations abuse and blah, blah, blah. And no, we talked a lot about case studies and, you know, U of T is awesome, but it's much more conservative than I had thought. Mm-hmm. I thought it was going to be like wild and radical and we were going to save the world and do protests with Greenpeace. No. The biggest thing about it was that I got one-on-one experience working with students because I did a placement at York University doing psychotherapy. Mm-hmm. I did a placement at, you know, Women's College Hospital working with sexual assault workers. And what I found working with survivors of trauma is that using creativity in my approach, I was really interested in narrative therapy, was a powerful way to get them to talk. Mm-hmm. You know, if you do storytelling or if you sort of externalize it, so you're talking about yourself, but you're telling a story, it helped people heal themselves. So I thought, okay, this medium, again, is really powerful. Mm-hmm. So when I took this course with Bonnie Burstow, she's this amazing, you know, radical feminist author. She said, create a tool that you can use for people who have survived trauma. I wrote a play. Mm-hmm. And the play ended up, you know, sort of blowing up. It was really random. It was, it's called Mary Kahani, and it means my story. And I wrote a series of stories about South Asian women in different parts of the world and different issues that would affect them, some of them happy, some of them sad, some of them, you know, shocking. And I actually interviewed service providers, you know, who had worked with women and dealt with HIV, dealt with rape, incest, arranged marriage. But I used the method of storytelling to tell their stories. And I was actually approached by an organization to produce the play. Mm. And I wasn't expecting it. So I thought, okay, shit, all right, let's do this. So I had, like, you know, casting sessions at U of T. I produced a show with a friend of mine at Hart House, and then all this media showed up. Someone sent out a press release. And it was really random. Next thing you know, I was getting all these calls from the Toronto Star and CBC, and there's another provider, Omni Television, saying, you know, we want to interview you. It was like South Asian Stories Reveal, and I was like, okay. And I'm like on television after. And then I sort of became this like pseudo news reporter talking about social issues. Mm. And then I started getting interesting job offers that were coming to me. And one of them was working with people who are affected by HIV. Mm-hmm. And when I, you know, I saw it was called ASAP, Alliance for South Asian AIDS Prevention. And when I went there, I thought, ooh, this group is really sassy. It was fun. It was creative. It was people who were looking at HIV in a way of, like, positivity, empowerment. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, you know, this is what you're living with, but how are you going to do it and do it well? And I became their publicist, and I didn't know how to do that. I just literally Googled how to become a publicist. Mm-hmm. But they believed in me. I told them, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And they said, well, you're doing something right. So I said, okay, let's do this. So I Googled how to write a press release, you know, and I just sort of contacted the same news providers that were coming to me saying, look, you know, these people have interesting stories to tell. Mm-hmm. You need to tell these stories. And then I started throwing fundraisers for them, but really fun fundraisers. Like we did condom fashion shows, you know, we did, you know, this event that for World AIDS Day, I called it Stimulation Night of the Senses. And we turned it into this fun celebratory event that became an annual thing. And we were selling, you know, bamboo sticks at subway stops and making commercials and doing photo shoots for calendars to raise awareness. And I love that job. Mm-hmm. And it was at that job that I started to, you know, think more. I said, I remember sitting at my desk and this idea just went into my head saying, I want to become a producer. Mm-hmm. And I remember telling my boyfriend at the time that I want to become a producer. And he was like, oh, God, what the hell? Like, one day you want to be a therapist, one day you want to be a producer, like, what? And I said, yeah, I want to be a producer. And this job came up at the city to work in public health, which is random. But I was interested in sexual health. I was interested in, you know, women's rights, you know, counseling people around sexuality. And so I applied for the job while I was doing the job in HIV, and I got it. And I was actually working on a sexual health info line. It was so random. But I loved it. It was like one-on-one counseling. It was very real. It was authentic. It was people, you know, talking about very serious issues, but also people being vulnerable. And I liked that engagement. So I didn't lose touch with, you know, my therapist side while I was being creative. So I felt like I was able to balance both. Until I was getting the masturbators who kept calling on the phone line because it was an anonymous line. And I was literally like, okay, I can't handle this anymore. No. I think they like the sound of my voice. So I would get these chronic masturbators calling me. And one day I was like, this is enough. And I went on the job board and the City of Toronto special events job came up. And I said, there's no way in hell I'm going to get this job. And I was, I don't know if it's Kismet, I was sitting beside an HR prof who was also working on the sexual health line. And she said, I think you should apply. And she said, your experience is different, but I'll show you how to organize yourself. She said, yeah. Apply. This is how you organize your resume. You know, she said that divide it up into your social work experience, you know, your community development experience. Because I also had a job at the Harborfront for a couple of years working in festivals. And yeah. while I was doing HIV and, you know, counseling, it was very random. But I loved it all and I just didn't want to choose one. Mm-hmm. So she said, I think you have all the parts. Feel confident, apply, and make a portfolio. So I said, okay, sure. I Googled how to make a portfolio. I remember going to Staples and photocopying my articles, telling my cousin, I don't know what the hell I'm doing, but I'm just going to do it. I went for the interview, and I was the first person they interviewed, and they were asking me about my experience. And I told them, you know, I've done plays, and I've done HIV counseling, and I've done all kinds of psychotherapy work. I said, but if I can tell you one thing, I've learned that art heals people.
Yeah.
You know, artists are making a statement with their craft. Artists are telling their story. Artists are holding a mirror up to society, and I get that. Mm-hmm. I said, I may not understand contemporary art, but I understand people, and I understand artists, and I understand the power of art. Because
mm-hmm.
they were kind of saying to me, we just inherited this new event called Nuit Blanche, and we're trying to understand it because you're dealing with contemporary visual artists that mm-hmm. work with, you know, political, strong, engaged works that we want to make sure we're not offending them, and we want to make sure we're, you know, being like really good producers, and that we're using the right language.
Yeah.
You know, terminology is really important, you know. And I said, yeah, so I don't really know about the art stuff, but I know about the people stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then I didn't think I had the job. I left saying whatever, and I got the call saying I got the job. So then I was like, oh shit, here I go again. I was absolutely terrified, but my gut said, you need to take this job. So it was terrifying when I walked into City Hall. I had developed a pretty good career for myself as a social worker with like a lot of media and, you know, acclaim around my play because I was doing something provocative. And I had started at the bottom in contemporary
mm-hmm.
art.
Mm-hmm.
So when I walked into City Hall, you know, there were some warm faces, but there was also like, what is she doing here? She's a social worker.
Mm-hmm.
And that was hard in the beginning. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I sort of realized that I just need to be me. Mm-hmm. You know, I can't say that I come from contemporary dance, or, you know, I don't have an MFA, or I don't come from Emily Carr, or all these things. I have a psych background. I have mm-hmm. a social work background. I have a community development background. But I have to say, I'm the longest programmer standing 9 years later.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I did something right.
Right. So and of course, by now, you've picked up a lot of sense of what's happening in the contemporary art world
mm-hmm.
and met a lot of artists and mm-hmm. curators. And so is there one project that really stands out for you in your
yeah.
mind?
Yeah. I mean, and you're right. I've, you know, over my years, I've dealt with huge international artists, like people who've worked with Ai Weiwei, Yoko Ono, like Jeff Koons, JR, Daniel Lanois, Anish Kapoor, you know, big, large international artists. I've worked with many local artists, gallerists, you know, and the biggest thing is connection.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because I'm, you know, what I say, real, people like that.
Mm-hmm.
People can sniff something that's, you know, a bureaucratic or mm-hmm. elitist right away.
Yeah.
And artists want what's real and authentic.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, the one project that stands out in my mind was in 2009, my curators, Jim Drobnik and Jennifer Fisher, they're professors one's at OCAD U and one's at York, they had an exhibition area called Night Sense.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the best exhibition areas I've seen. And it was all about the sixth sense that comes alive at night.
Mm-hmm.
And because I know how to work with, you know, a range of personalities,
yeah.
I was the person that I was assigned this exhibition because it's about the sixth sense. What is it? That's intuition.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that is kind of in a spiritual realm. That is something that's not tangible. It's conceptual. And it's also about belief, you
mm-hmm.
know. And I'm open to people's belief systems, and I'm non-judgmental. So I said, yeah, let's do this. I love exploring the sixth sense. So this particular piece was called Witch's Cradle.
Mm-hmm.
And so the idea, my curator said, oh, I read this story and I want to recreate what would happen in Salem when witches were tortured. So they were literally hung. Yeah. Hung in these satchels, like, so these sort of, if you can imagine, like black saps. It's almost like literally sap from a tree, and hung over the branches of the tree where they would be in there. And basically, you know, that was how they were tortured, because they, all their senses were cut off, and they were meant to hang in these, you know, satchels until they died or until they suffocated or, you know, whatever. But the difference is, there's stories written about the women in there saying that they actually enjoyed it because it gave them a sense of euphoria, and, you know, because all of their senses were sort of deprived from them, it sort of put them in like a state of enlightenment. So we recreated witches' cradles in Brookfield Place, and I thought, this is insane, you know, like, how the hell are we going to do this? But I was absolutely astounded that we committed to it and we did it. We designed the piece, we worked with a group of artists, and we brought them in, and we literally hung six sort of saps, if you can imagine, like black, you know, sacks hanging from the ceiling of Brookfield Place. And Brookfield Place is 60 feet high. Mm-hmm. So we had to hang them so that we're literally like 5 feet off the ground. We had people inside the sacks. So then we had to make sure that we had heart monitors on those people. Mm-hmm. The artist wanted them to be blindfolded. So Center for Tactical Magic is the artist, and they actually believe in magic, which is cool. So they came in and they said, no, the people need to be blindfolded. We as a city had to make sure they were safe.
Yeah.
So we had heart monitors mm-hmm. on their like index finger. We had a doctor on site monitoring their heart. They had to sign off on waivers. Mm-hmm. We had the facilitators wearing these crazy black jumpsuits, almost like, you know, jail jumpsuits with stars on them. And it was insane. I was like, this project is insane. You know, we're dealing with the masses. How are people going to participate in this without, you know, thinking that we're freaks or that they're going to scream and run and, you know, maybe cause chaos?
So were the people that were in, that were inside, they were members of the public?
Yeah.
Or they, oh, I see.
And the result was absolutely astounding. It was the most beautiful, extraordinary pieces I've ever seen in my life. Like, it was like almost like we were in space, like we were in this other world where you walked in with the lighting, you know, seeing these sacks, like six of them row by row, people in them, people watching them. So we had barricaded all of it. And in Brookfield Place, there's six squares on the ground that's lit up. So we had a sack on top of each square.
Right.
People stood in line. It was pin drop silence.
Wow.
They were in awe. And they were in the sacks and they were levitating. And when they would come out, they'd have this look on their face like, wow, I have never experienced sensory deprivation like that. And they would be quiet and walk away, and the next person would go in, and the next person. We did that for 12 hours. And that's when I thought, this event is extraordinary. Mm. Because you walk outside on Bay Street, you know, it was mayhem with 1.2 million people, and then you walk inside Brookfield Place, and it's pin drop silence.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
So it was a very powerful project. It's probably, you know, it was one of my favorite projects to date.
Mm-hmm. So speaking of mayhem, Nuit Blanche is like really big and brash and eye-catching. And what do you think that says about our culture, these big events? Like, it mm-hmm. seems like that's sort of what's happening mm-hmm. A lot. There's a lot of these large contemporary art events.
I think that, you know, inherently we're creatures of attachment. And I think that people want to connect with other people. And so when you go to a gallery, it's cool because you're in a white cube and you're in a smaller space, but you're not connecting to the person beside you.
Yes.
You know, and what I love about Nuit is that everybody is a community. You know, and yes, you know, some parts of it can have higher energy, but for the most part, you know, people are all standing in line to experience the work. People come in groups. People are talking to each other. People mm-hmm. are engaged. And I think, you know, the whole idea of just going into a white cube is fine, but, you know, Toronto is a thriving scene where the street and the, you know, institution are meeting
mm-hmm.
because they're both relevant. Street culture is huge, the institutional culture is huge, and I think what's so great about Nuit is that we're taking art out of the institutions, putting them into the streets.
Mm-hmm. And you do collaborate with different art institutions around the city.
Absolutely. You know, every single one. You know, Design Exchange, Power Plant, Harbor Front Center, Drake 150, Gladstone, you know, Gardner, ROM, AGO, we all collaborate. Mm-hmm. And we cite projects there, and they do their own independent projects. And I think if you look at First Thursdays, which is a hugely successful event, mm-hmm. I partner with them for Nuit Blanche, and they said to me during my last partnership with them that when you program this event, it felt like the city was inside our institution, and we love that.
So what's the First Thursday?
First Thursdays is an event that is very cheap to get in. It's probably like $8. But once you get inside, there's DJs, there's food, there's programming, there's lighting. So you feel like you're in this world inside mm-hmm. the gallery. It's turned upside down, and it's become this sort of public, you know, space, and it's a special event for the night.
Right.
And so people are dancing mm-hmm. in front of, you know, a Picasso. Mm-hmm. And it's super fun, and it's accessible, and it's getting mass crowds back into the galleries.
Right.
You know, because I think AGO was finding, a lot of institutions were finding, that the numbers were falling. Mm-hmm. Because as we're walking into the millennial culture, millennials have everything accessible to them online. Mm-hmm. If they can't see it online, they don't care. So they were trying to find a way, or Matthew Teitelbaum was trying to find a way to get the masses into the galleries, and so he created an environment that, you know, invited them to sort of have a party in there, but, you know, an educated party, a mm-hmm. cultural party, mm-hmm. an art party, and everybody came.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the thing that you can't really get online, is that real connection, mm-hmm. Interpersonal connection with people together sharing mm-hmm. an experience.
Yeah.
In the real world.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, the galleries have their place, but the streets are where a lot of art is born, a lot mm-hmm. of culture is born.
Yeah.
And I think what's so great about Nui is the street culture, because if you go around, there's so many projects that are happening in and around that people are doing on their own, and people are participating yes. with them, and that's great too.
Yeah.
And so it becomes this one night of engaging in art citywide, and so we're pretty proud of that, and it's for free. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, if it wasn't for free, I don't know if I would be working there, because I'm always thinking about purpose.
Mm-hmm. So, Umbreen, thank you so much for doing this interview.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.